ABC. How you going? Thank you.
Good morning, Emma Haskin on Desert Tracks. Today, I am sitting in the beating heart of the only surviving, albeit digital, newspaper, the Alice Springs News, which was started by my next guest and her partner in 1994. But there's a bit of a journey between then and now. And it's a very good morning to my guest, Kieran Fidane, journalist and author. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Emma.
Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Sydney, but my family didn't live there. They lived in Katoomba. It's a small town in the Blue Mountains. So I was taken back there and spent my first 7 years in the Blue Mountains. And I regard that as my home country, if you like.
Was it as delightful as it sounds?
I think so. It's a magnificent landscape, very strongly contrasting seasons. So it snowed there in winter. Wonderful autumns, with a lot of leaf fall, probably from European trees, but I can remember playing in great piles of leaves in autumn with other children, falling into snow-filled ditches in winter, and then, of course, it gets hot there in summer. You can have raging bushfires, as we know. So, yeah, it was a great place to grow up.
And you're one of six children, so yes. Did you play with your siblings?
Mainly, although there were other families around, of course. So it was a very Catholic community that we mixed in up there. My father taught in the local high school, state high school, but we all went to the Catholic primary school, and it was a strongly religious family upbringing that I had.
Where are you in the family order?
I'm number three, and that is probably significant.
In what way?
In thinking about my family, I feel like my brother and sister who came before me had a very clear sense of their path in life. And I think from me through the other siblings, all of them girls, we were less certain of our direction and explored a lot before finally making a choice later in life.
And what did your mother do, as aside from looking after a hoard load of children?
Yeah, she's interesting, my mother. Very inspiring woman, still alive, 94 years old. So she put herself through university, unusual at the time, the first person in her family to go to university.
What year are we talking?
So we're talking pre-Second World War. And she studied economics, so also quite unusual. She was one of only a few female students in that subject. Very clever, very determined, but nonetheless of her era. And when she met my father and married, so for like a lot of women in that post-war generation, she was not going to have a career outside of the home. She really dedicated herself to raising her family.
And how, you said that it was a Catholic-dominated family, how important was religion in your day-to-day lives?
It played a big role. So I think the thing that has lasted with me is my parents' focus on social justice. So both my parents were from working-class families, and through education, I guess, moved us into the middle class, if you like. So both of them went to university and got their degrees and became qualified, unlike their parents. They had, you know, very difficult childhoods through the Depression. Their parents weren't people who owned property, for example. And so they had this very strong consciousness of people who, the poor, people less well off than themselves. And that pervaded the conversation in our home, I think, and where we should orient our own values. So that was a strong part of it. But there was also a life of prayer, church going, Bible reading, our own family rituals around big feast days, for example. So I can remember when we were living in Katoomba, I went through a very pious period and would get up at the crack of dawn to go to Mass every day with my father through Lent. So it was certainly very important.
Does that resonate in this day and age?
I don't describe myself as a Catholic any longer, but I think that experience culturally is very significant. And I think it has been quite interesting for me to get in touch with that recently when I've been writing a book about peace activists, many of whom are Catholic. I think it made me quite open to talking to them about what their beliefs are and the way it motivated them in their actions in every other part of their lives as well. Made me not resistant to them culturally.
So you said you lived in Katoomba till you were around 7 years of age?
Yes. So the family moved to Sydney, which is where my parents are from. They grew up there and they remained there. My father's no longer alive, but they are strongly attached Sydneysiders.
How did that shape what you wanted to become?
Well, it took me a long time to get to where I have a clear sense of what I want to do. But always in the background was this, social awareness, I guess you could describe it as political awareness. A significant thing in my schooling, actually, was to leave Catholic school. And possibly my parents would blame that in part on departure from the faith, being a believing Catholic. So from the equivalent of year 10, I went to Sydney Girls High School. So that had quite a cultural impact. You know, again, a much more multicultural school, particularly a very large group of students who were the children of European post-war, in particular Jewish settlement in Sydney. These were my close friends, and it opened up sort of different picture of the world to me, fairly Europe-oriented, I guess. I was, keenly interested in Europe culturally and its history, including, or in particular, that 20th century history. So then I went to university. I wasn't the most dedicated student. I felt ambivalent about formal studies.
Was this at the time when university was free?
It was. Ungrateful me, in a sense, So many people would, kill for the opportunity of going to university. But it was a time of a lot of social upheaval, a lot of rebellion against the values of our parents' generation. It was a very hard time for my parents, I think.
Were you rebellious?
Yeah, I was. I was more rebellious in the sort of lifestyle sense of finding that those very conservative values, particularly around, I guess, personal morality, if you like, relationships, lifestyle, that all a bit suffocating, and wanted to be out there experiencing the exciting world.
And how did your parents take that?
As I said, I think it was a very hard time for them. I think that frightened them, the possibility of me losing my way.
Let's talk about your first track here on Desert Tracks. It is Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed. Why have you chosen this particular song?
Well, it makes me laugh, actually. And people who know me now might think, really? but it relates to that very rebellious period of my life and a major event culturally for people of my generation, which is the Aquarius Festival at Nimbin in northern New South Wales.
Oh, my goodness, you're a hippie. Are you?
Well,
for that particular occasion, you might have been.
Yeah, I would have looked like one for sure. long flowing dresses and long streaming hair and bare feet and no bra.
So tell me about that festival.
So it was a fantastic occasion, and how the Lou Reed track comes into it is just because I hitchhiked to get there. Probably should describe it as a rideshare rather than a hitchhike, but it was with someone I didn't know very well. But I got into this vehicle and he was obsessed with that song and played it nearly non-stop all the way. And it is a superb song. I think it was ingrained in my mind ever since.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side.
That was Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed, my guest first track here on Desert Tracks today. I am sitting out on a bush block here in Central Australia. It is a Overcast, unusually overcast day here in the Red Centre. Well, my guest this morning, she is a journalist and she's also an author. It's Kieran Fennane. And let's go to France.
So I had finished my degree. Yeah, was very uncertain about what I wanted to do. And in a way, going to France was just taking another exploratory step and trying to find that focus. I chose France because it wasn't England. I think a lot of my generation went to England, you know, and it was easier probably to get work there. But I worked in France teaching English as a second language. Also was able to study in France. They have a very generous system towards foreign students, and it was a very stimulating 5 years that I spent there. I happened to arrive in the year that the socialist president, François Mitterrand, was elected. So it was a time of a lot of excited change. So I had a bursary to do an intensive course in ethnographic filmmaking. And I was also studying what they call a university diploma in cinema studies, which included some script writing subjects, but also history of cinema was studies rather than hands-on filmmaking, whereas the ethnographic filmmaking was hands-on. I actually made a film there. I actually looked at the class of people who were entering the IT industry. So really in the very early stages, I met them because I was teaching them English or practicing English with them. And they all had very interesting backgrounds from very different kind of milieu. And it made a really interesting doco about the contrast that this new industry was bringing to life.
Yeah. Were you doing all of this in French?
Yes. So I had only schoolgirl French when I arrived, but I put a big effort into becoming fluent and literate.
Was it tough to do that?
No, it's what you're there for, really, that immersion in the other country. And no, I enjoyed it.
How welcoming were French people to an outsider like yourself from Australia?
I found many wonderfully welcoming French people, who I remain in touch with to this day, I know they have a reputation, and I mean, I often came across it too, particularly an intolerance for, you know, the poor command of their language, but it was a mixed bag, but I had some wonderfully supportive, interesting friends there. They have a program or had, I'm not even sure if it's still the case, in France where enterprise have to devote a certain amount of their money to the ongoing education of their staff. And so even in a factory, you'll have this kind of program. And sometimes workers would put their hand up for English. And there was one funny group, and really it was just nigh on impossible to get them to accept that the language that they were learning wasn't French, wasn't going to obey French rules. It would have its own rules and its own pronunciations and so on. They were funny. They just couldn't wrap their heads around it. So we used to just play card games using English numbers and pass a jolly time together. This would be in their lunch break, and something interesting to observe was the wine drunk while they're at work, not only for lunch, but also at morning tea. Yeah, it was extraordinary.
Tell me about coming back. What made you decide to come back?
Yes, it was a thought that occurred to me in talking about not overselling the whole experience of living in Paris. There's this sense that was, I could never really share with the people, as much as I loved them, they loved me, share with them that commonality of language, experience, identity, I guess, of having something at stake in the country where you are. And I thought after 5 years that I wanted that again.
So when did you come back to Australia? Was it 1987? Is that about right?
So it was 1989, the start of 1986, I think.
And what did you do when you got home?
So I was very lucky. You know, I had that those film studies behind me and that, you know, start in the filmmaking industry, if you like, some training in that direction. And I got a job substantially through who I knew rather than what I knew, one of those great opportunities with a television production company, Kennedy Miller. So I started producing a series for them called Sports Crazy. And again, people who know me now, not at all a sporty person, but the sports that they were looking at were the unusual sports in regional Australia. And it was the Finke Desert Race in Alice Springs that first brought me to Alice Springs.
How did you even get your head around what the Finke Desert Race was back then?
I guess I was a curious enough person, and especially when given an assignment. I'm happy to talk to people. And one of the key people I was talking to in those days was Damien Ryan, which makes me laugh when I think of all the years that have passed since and where we've both ended up. So I was producing, so we came with some crew, but I was looking for local crew as well. And this is what when I met Erwin Kander. This was the fateful occasion in Damien Ryan's lounge room, actually. So I asked Damien, who was vice president of the racing club, if there were camera operators around. And Erwin had already made a bit of a name for himself covering the Finke and was doing freelance television work in Central Australia as well as working for The Advocate at that time. And so he said, yeah, there's someone in particular, and he had him come over. And that was the start of a long relationship.
At what point in time did you decide that, okay, I need to move to Central Australia?
So having hired Erwin to cover the Finke Desert Race, he was a very can-do operator, and we were in that kind of environment all around Australia in these out-of-the-way locations with often, you know, surprising demands being made on us to cover these endurance events, but also just really quirky sports like lizard racing and cane toad racing. And particularly it was the endurance sports that where he was going to be really useful. So the production team took him on for many of the episodes, and he came and based himself in Sydney. And when we finished that production, we went back to France, where I made a film in France. And after that, we decided to come back and that I would move to Alice Springs.
Given that you'd been probably in and out of Central Australia, what struck you about this region that has made you stay here for, what, 30-odd years?
Yes, more than 30 now. In the beginning, I think just the sheer contrast, the seeming openness of it, the sense of it being a part of Australia that I and my family, my friends of that time knew nothing about, and yet it felt like it was an important place to know something about. Did I mention the beauty, the lifestyle? Really loved camping, exploring the remote areas of Central Australia. That was the work Erwin and I worked together then. We were freelancing for TV stations around the country when they actually had budgets to commission, you know, nice magazine pieces. And we did a lot of interesting work all over the region. And, yeah, I loved it. It was completely different from everything that I'd known growing up. I think I might have slept in the open once or twice as a young person, but yeah, just that thrill of sleeping under the stars here, of living closer to the ground. I loved it.
In 1994, you both decided to start a newspaper here. Why start a paper? There was a paper here at that time, The Advocate, which has since very recently closed down. But why did you want to have that competition with a very popular newspaper?
I will answer that question, but it came after sort of major life events for me, which and for her, no doubt, which was that we had our two children. And that might be connected with that sense of commitment to the town and to the future of the town that was in both of us. That sense of having children born here and intending to raise them here made us feel like we wanted to have our work contribute more directly to the life of the town. I actually wrote one or two pieces, I think, The Advocate early days, and Irwin certainly, you know, he had quite a long history of employment with them. Occasionally he'd been their chief of staff. I mean, for years he was their chief of staff. Perhaps there was could have been an entree there for us, but we felt like we had an idea for the kind of focus that just wasn't there. It was a different style of journalism, I suppose, more investigative, particularly Irwin's journalism, more reflective, mine, and observational, and longer pieces, and just a broader scope.
Did you ever think you'd see the day where you would be the only paper here in Central Australia?
I think Irwin secretly nurtured that ambition, not so secretly probably. We fulfilled different roles.
What does this say in the greater scheme of journalism when regional papers are closing? What does that say to you?
Well, I think it is of deep concern. They allowed themselves to soft pedal editorially all the time in order to be supported by the advertising interests that were substantial of government, governments, plural, and major corporations. And I think that is quite damaging to the role of a serious journalistic medium. I think you have to separate those interests, and the reporting has to be as fearless as it can be.
So in 2003, your family went through would you call it a personal tragedy when your house burnt down? What happened?
Look, it's a hard experience to lose the roof over your head and also everything that you have owned to that point, virtually everything.
Was it day or night?
So it happened at night, but we were not at home. So that's why the house burnt so down to the ground, because we weren't here. We were actually bushwalking with our son, Rainer. Our daughter was interstate visiting cousins. The first we knew of it were phone calls in the morning from a dear neighbour saying, "I'm sorry, but your house is burnt to the ground. It's gutted. There's nothing."
What was your initial reaction?
Disbelief, but something was quite an interesting first morning, actually, because we're out bush and we'd only just came into range. He'd been trying to contact us for hours. We came into range and he said, "Well, I'll come and get you." But we had to walk a few kilometres to get to a point where he could pick us up. And that was a very good thing to have to do in terms of coping with shock. And I would always recommend it to people that if you've had a shock, try and walk. And I guess it keeps you breathing. And we had that time to talk to one another and start to think about what it would mean and what prepare ourselves for the sight that would confront us when we got home.
Could anything prepare you for that?
I suppose not. And I can remember a funny feeling. So friends turned up. We had this sort of mental preparation. And as we arrived, other friends who'd heard about it on the grapevine also arrived out of deep concern for us. Some of them were crying, but I wasn't crying. I felt a bit upset that we had made these people sort of disrupted their day, made them cry. I felt like I should be cleaning up and making everyone a cup of tea when that was impossible. But what did really upset me and touch me was to see my son, dear son, his lips quivering. He was very self-contained too. And I must say both of the children really didn't spend too much time feeling sorry for themselves, and I admired that about them.
Did you... You would have lost, you know, all these mementos of them as babies and photos and all those sorts of things. How do you...
I know people think that, you know, this is just... It is. Look, that meant a lot to me. One of the things I can remember crying over was, you know, some days later coming into the burnt wreck of the house. I don't even know why I was there. And discovering all of their children's storybooks, which were completely charred on the outside, but the pages weren't. So you could open them and still see the beautiful illustrations and the text and so on. And I can remember really weeping about that. But I think the thing that I was crying about was the sense of, you know, the loss that you have in being alive, that time passes, you lose your children's childhoods in that sense, that beautiful time of when you're with them reading stories to them. I think it was the emotion that was brought up in me. I think something very, very consoling for our whole family was the kindness of people around us, and it was outstanding. And so not only our good close friends, but people who only knew us by reputation, for example, through what we do, or even just by word of mouth. These are people in our community who've lost everything. I can remember the extraordinary experience of going in to order a coffee in Bar Doppio's, as it was then, and seeing a little sign on the desk near the cash register saying, you know, please donate here for Kieran and Erwin. And I just, I said, oh, please, you know, like there are people who need more than we do.
Did you ever find out what caused the fire?
No, things were so thoroughly destroyed that it was hard to determine, but the investigator's best guess was that it was a television. The pilot, for the remote, that little red light that comes on that particular model had been implicated before in house fires, apparently. And it had overheated and fallen onto the carpet was what he thought might have happened. So not clear on that, but yeah. But I just would say about that I think when you're a family in a community, and perhaps especially a community such as ours, where I think people will rally around and help one another, you're just one family that this has happened to, and there's the resources in the community to support you, including emotionally. That's a very different experience from the trauma that people, for instance, on the South Coast must have gone through last summer, when so many of their communities were affected and so many are in trauma, and it just, you know, that resource of human kindness is stretched to its limits. And so I think we recovered quickly and well from our loss, really.
You've described Alice Springs as a giant casualty ward in your 2016 book, Trouble. Tell me a little bit about why you described Alice Springs like that.
Well, Trouble, as you know, is focused on my reporting of a series of criminal trials. So between 2009 and 2015... And the conditions for all of those events probably haven't changed a lot. And possibly if I was going into the courts, I'd be finding trials like them. But the particular ones that I chose really showed a lot of the stresses in our community.
What are some of those stressors, do you think?
Well, particularly it's in the relationships between Aboriginal people and the so-called mainstream or the dominant white culture. And I still think that we have got so much work to do in that area of relationship building and resetting and thinking about what kind of future we want to have together. I'm always struck by the embrace of a way forward together that is spoken of by Aboriginal people in positions of leadership in particular. But I don't know to what extent we hear that from others.
When we talk about the casualty ward, the level of violent crime, the court cases that you sat through, they were violent.
Yes, all of them were crimes of violence, without a doubt. I think almost all of them, if not all, were fueled by a very high level of consumption of alcohol.
How did covering those violent crimes, how did that affect you, do you think?
It's dark material in that book. It speaks for itself that I have stopped doing a lot of that court reporting. So the next trial that I covered after publishing Trouble was the trial of the Peace Pilgrims.
Let's talk about your second track here on Desert Tracks. It's a Nina Simone track. I'll let you pronounce it, given that I learnt German, not French.
Ne me quitte pas.
And what does it mean?
It means don't leave me.
And why have you chosen this particular song?
I love it. It's a song that I have been listening to recently. But I chose it, I suppose, because it reflects something that was an important turning point in my life. So that was the experience of another culture. And for me, it happened to be French culture. And I think that experience of living away from my country, my family, did introduce a kind of different emotionality in my life, something that was more intense, probably more serious. I think while I was there, it shaped what I would do in the future more than probably any other experience.
Let's have a listen. Here's Nina Simone, and thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Emma. It's been very enjoyable.
Il faut oublier tout, pas s'oublier, qui s'enfuit déjà. Oublier le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu à savoir comment. Oublier ces heures qui tuait parfois au coup de pourquoi le cœur.